From WIPR in Baltimore, I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday Health Watch. Last week, the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, released an outline of how Republicans might replace the Affordable Care Act. It includes changes to Medicaid, grants to states, health savings accounts, and tax credits. Today, the U.S. Conference of Mayors is calling for a national day of action to talk about the consequences of repealing Obamacare. The mayors point to an impact on the health and safety of low-income residents in their cities and the financial strain changes may put on local hospitals. Today on the Midday Health Watch, Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, joins me to talk about what the effects of an ACA repeal might be on Charm City. We'll take your calls, your questions, and your comments. The Midday Health Watch gets underway right after this hour's headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody. Very glad that you're with us this afternoon. I'm Tom Hall. Last Thursday, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan unveiled what he called a policy brief on repealing and replacing Obamacare. A repeal of the Affordable Care Act would, of course, have a dramatic effect on people purchasing insurance on the open market and even those who are insured through their employer. But a repeal of the law as it now stands would also have a dramatic effect on many public health programs. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch, our monthly visit with Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. We'll talk about, among other things, what the consequences on public health might be if the Affordable Care Act is either repealed or substantially replaced. You are welcome to join our conversations with your questions and comments for Dr. Wen. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, Tom.
And let's start with some really wonderful, exciting news for you and your family. You look radiant today, I must say. I can report with all assurance that you just look terrific. But your family's about to expand.
It is. My husband, Sebastian, and I are nervous. We are excited. We are about to be first-time parents. And actually, this is the first day that I'm speaking about this publicly. We've let our family know for some time. We've just told our friends. And I guess now we're telling all the listeners of your show on
Midday. Great. Well, that's terrific. So when do you do? What's your due date?
I'm due in August. Mm-hmm. And, the first trimester has been, for everyone who's been there, has been full of a lot of uncertainties. I'm a physician, and maybe it's one of those things that I know too much about what could go wrong. But
sure,
there are so many things that I didn't even realize. I mean, not just how to deal with morning sickness and fatigue, but also about diet and exercise. What's okay to eat? What's not okay to eat? How to deal with the...
Often a moving target, too, isn't it? Because what's okay to eat in, 1990 might not be okay in 2000, and, it might be okay again in 2015.
That's right. And there seems to be a lot of conflicting advice at times. And so even sorting that out has been a challenge, an interesting challenge. But I've also thought a lot about just how lucky I am as well. I mean, I have an incredibly supportive team at the Baltimore City Health Department who have been so understanding about helping me to adjust my schedule. I mean, it really is taking a village. And I think about my mother, who at the time of being pregnant with my sister, she was an immigrant in this country, working three different jobs, going to night school, raising me as well. She and so many other people don't have that privilege, don't have that support that I'm really fortunate to benefit from. And so I think just in this really short period of time, it's given me a very different perspective on being not only being a medical professional, but also being a working person and all the challenges that we face.
I bet it has. I've been a dad for 28 years, and it changed my life more than anything has ever changed my life. And I will just say that, first of all, congratulations to you and your husband. You've got a lucky baby perking away in there, and that's great. But you love your parents, you love your husband, your wife, you love your job, you love your friends. There is nothing like loving your kid. Nothing. It's sui generis. And so I'm delighted for you. I think it's really going to be great, and it will inform to be sure, everything you do, not just your professional life, but every your relationships with everybody and your sense of what's possible in the world, you know. So that's just great. That's terrific. So
you
mentioned, you know, there's so many young families, young mothers who are going through this experience without the kind of support you have, without the kind of backup that you're lucky to have because of your position, your education, your knowledge as a physician. The Affordable Care Act is something that has, by many counts, been something that really has helped young mothers with their in vitro care and their postpartum care with their new babies. I mean, that's something that the Affordable Health Care Act did try to identify in terms of preventive care and keeping young people healthy as they're going through the experience of pregnancy and birth. As you think about, you know, what may or may not happen with the affordable health care, what are some of the things sort of top of line for you, top of mind for you about the effects that we could see, you know, here in Baltimore and around the country?
When I think about what could happen if the ACA were repealed, I get extremely worried and very anxious. I saw what healthcare was like before the ACA. I met women who never got their cervical cancer screening, never got their mammograms because they couldn't afford it. Even after they discovered that something was wrong, they discovered a lump in their breast, they discovered other symptoms, it took them years potentially to get treated. At a point that something that is now life-threatening could have been prevented had they sought care earlier if they could have afforded it. I saw all these children who did not get routine vaccinations because they couldn't pay for them, perhaps because they were uninsured. So many individuals who did not take their medications, who made a choice between paying for medications and paying for food for their families. That's what healthcare was like. I remember those days of taking care of these patients and thinking, who are we in this world, in this civilized society? Who are we in this wealthiest nation in the world if we can't take care of our most vulnerable? And not just one person, but millions and millions of them. We've come a long way. I mean, the ACA is not perfect. There are many things to be fixed within the ACA. But to take away this precious healthcare coverage from millions of Americans who are benefiting for the first time, it's unconscionable to me. It doesn't make sense. It's unscientific. And it's not something that I, as a physician, a public health official, or a person can really accept.
Today is a national day of action called by the U.S. Conference of Mayors to talk in cities across the country about the possible consequences. And they highlight in particular the potential impact on low-income families and also on hospitals and the costs that hospitals may end up incurring. I know the mayor of Los Angeles was quoted in a story that Amy Scott did from Marketplace just this morning. And he said that if we're going to go back to the days where uninsured people call 911 and use a city firefighter, paramedic, or an emergency room as an approach to health care, that's going to get very expensive very quickly. And he's talking about Los Angeles. You know, the mayor of Philadelphia estimates there could be as many as 200,000 people in the city of Philadelphia who lose their health care if it's repealed. The impact here is financial as well as physical. Do you have a guesstimate as to how many people in Baltimore who are currently covered might not be covered if the plan changes significantly?
We know that there are at least 40,000 people who are insured after the ACA here in Baltimore City. And these individuals could all lose coverage. There may be even more individuals who lose coverage. But it's not just a matter of health insurance itself, which is an important part of the ACA. And I absolutely encourage everyone to take part in the day of action by telling their stories. If you or someone you know now has insurance, now are able to get your medical conditions treated, this is the time to speak up and say why this is so important to you. I mean, I've seen patients who told me that health insurance has been their rock, that health insurance helped to get their life back on track. I mean, this is the time for us to talk about why this is not just a policy issue, but the ACA is about people's lives. But we also have to make the point, as you did very well, Tom, that it's not just a matter of let's talk about health insurance, let's talk about these abstract concepts. We also have to pin it specifically to cost savings. I can treat a patient who is having congestive heart failure now. But the individual with congestive heart failure, they could spend 3 weeks in the ICU, then they can go to a rehab, then they can go home after months. That individual, that entire hospital stay could have been prevented if we just addressed their high blood pressure earlier, if we just got them onto medications that they could afford earlier. A commitment to public health and a commitment to these core principles of prevention is a commitment to fiscal responsibility. So we have to talk about not just the cost of an intervention, we have to talk about the cost of doing nothing. And there's one final part about the ACA that people generally do not think about, which is that the ACA has a component called the Prevention and Public Health Fund. It funds nearly 1/7 of the budget of the federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. 1/7. And this is the fund that helps us to prepare for natural disasters, for emerging infections, for bioterrorism. So the ACA is not just about health insurance. It's not just about financial responsibility. It's actually also about national security.
So when there's an Ebola outbreak
The
Zika virus
things
like this, or if, heaven forbid, there should be some bioterrorism, the water supply or something, the ACA it takes those kinds of possibilities into account.
That's right. And repealing the ACA wholesale means that public health prevention fund also disappears. And it's going to put the lives of millions of Americans at risk because we won't be able to prepare for and respond to these disasters. This is a national security issue, and I hope that that's something that we can bring into our public discourse as well, because it's certainly something that I, as a frontline public health official, am thinking about every day.
Even President Obama and people like yourself who think the ACA has generally been a very good idea and an effective answer to the problem that, has afflicted the country for a long, long time, generations, literally, has said that, it could use some tweaking. Are there particular things about the law that you think should be taken a look at to adjust?
It's a huge challenge to balance the three pillars of controlling cost while providing high quality care, while also introducing value and ensuring that everyone is covered. I mean, it's a huge challenge. There have been improvements that are made. There are a lot more that have to be made. But I'm very concerned about the proposals that are on the table, which would further reduce access to care. Anything that reduces access to care is pulling us in the wrong direction. We have millions who still do not have ideal coverage. Many interventions people are still being priced out of them, including prescription drugs. I mean, there's a lot that we have to do to control the escalating price, which is then put onto consumers and patients. There are many different things that have to happen, but repealing something that is currently working and is helping millions of people is not the answer.
Paul Ryan talks about the increase in premiums that people have started to pay over the last year. This became a very hot campaign issue during the presidential campaign, particularly in the last couple of months when reports started coming out that, the average increase in premiums was 25%. The Ryan proposal identifies the markets falling apart, where many counties around the country have only one insurer offering health care. All of those things are on the cost side of it. Are there proposals that you've heard about that could address those problems, keep the premiums in check? I mean, I guess the idea was that eventually the premiums would go down when the pool of people being insured was larger to include lots of people who don't have to access the system very often, i.e. younger people who don't get sick as much.
Insurance works because of pooling risk. If we only have unhealthy people who seek medical care all the time in the system, of course, healthcare is going to be expensive and premiums are going to rise for everyone who is in that pool. It works. Insurance works if everyone is in and nobody is out, including, as you mentioned, Tom, people who are the quote-unquote healthy, wealthy, and wise, individuals who are healthy, who don't think that they need health insurance, but actually might. I mean, nobody plans to be ill. So our focus at Baltimore City has been getting everyone covered, letting everyone know that nobody plans to be ill. It's important to have health insurance, and also that it's not only an individual responsibility for yourself and your family, it's also our societal obligation to each other. And the proposals to rein in cost have to take into account that concept of individual mandate, because we need as many people in the pool as possible, while at the same time also looking at how can we go from fee-for-service care to value-based care to reduce cost. And the ACA has encouraged various models, testing different models for high-value care. And those have been going very well. There are some really interesting models that are evolving, including the experiment right here in Maryland of global budgeting, of helping to keep our hospital budgets in check by having hospitals be accountable to the health of populations. There are experiments that are working, and so let's not remove them wholesale, because the effect is going to be people's lives.
We will have more on the Affordable Care Act and other issues in the realm of public health. My guest is Dr. Lena Wend. She is Baltimore's City Health Commissioner, and in about 7 months, she will be the artist also known as Mom. You are listening to the Midday Health Watch. Our phone number, if you want to get involved in our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back with more with Dr. Wen after these words. Stick with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we're heading back to the kitchen with our resident foodies, Sasha Wollhandler of Sasha's 527 Restaurant and Catering, and John Shields of Gertrude's at the BMA. On tomorrow's installment of Whatcha Got Cooking, we'll talk about great ideas for one-pot meals. So we'd love to hear your ideas for how to feed a crowd or even just yourself with all the fixins in just one place. That's coming up tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Lena Wend, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City, and it is, as I mentioned, the Midday Health Watch. Let's hear your concerns, your comments, your experiences with the ACA. Let's hear your questions that you might have for Dr. Wend about issues pertaining to public health. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you want to drop us a tweet, @MiddayTomHall. So, Lena, it's estimated by some that Maryland overall could have upwards of 370,000 people losing their health care if Obamacare, or the ACA as it's known, is repealed. What, in terms of the transition, this is another thing that Speaker Ryan has talked about. Mr. Trump has promised that it will be smooth and seamless and perfect. You know, perhaps it'll be just as seamless as the rollout of the executive order on the immigration ban, but who knows? But what would you look to see to have happen if the law is changed in one way or the other, if it's changed in some substantial way, getting from old law to new law without losing a bunch of people in between?
Well, first, I hope that everyone will do our part to fight that as much as we can. Our legislators on the federal level, but also all of us as citizens, as concerned individuals who benefit ourselves from the ACA, who also want to safeguard the health and well-being of our fellow citizens. I hope that we can push back and talk about why repealing the ACA is something that is not a good idea for us as a society. My concern, to your point about the immediate impact, is that for so many of our patients, so many of our residents here in Maryland and across the country, there is no margin of error. Let's take someone who is on treatment for opioid addiction, who is receiving medications and counseling for mental health issues. These individuals, if they were to lose coverage today, they might go into withdrawal. for their addiction tomorrow, even tonight. They might then go onto the streets, use drugs again, and overdose and die. I mean, that is not a margin of error that would be acceptable. I've seen patients, for example, who ran out of their seizure medications and got and then ended up having, because they couldn't pay for their medications, couldn't pay for insurance, ended up going into comas and dying because they lost, they did not have access to that medication. And so we can't play around with people's lives. This is not a matter of let's tinker with this policy and see what happens. We need to make sure that every single person is covered, because coverage is about life.
You wrote an op-ed in The Sun about a month ago with Hank Greenberg, who is with AARP here in Maryland, and you said we cannot have an honest discussion about curtailing healthcare costs without looking at the double and even triple digit increases in some of the most commonly prescribed medications. So the cost of prescription drugs is a huge part of this discussion about healthcare costs overall. Where do you see that happening? There's some legislation here in the General Assembly in Maryland. There's some federal legislation as well, sort of floating around out there. But there's an example of this thing called Evzio, which is the thing that is used to deliver naloxone. And you and I have talked about how naloxone can be such a life-saving thing. This is an antidote to people who have overdosed. Do I have that correct?
Yes.
And it used to be $690 for a twin pack, and it's now $4,500. How does that happen?
Well, let's start from the beginning, which is to say that prescription drugs, the high price of prescription drugs is one of the most important drivers of escalating healthcare costs. And so to the question that we discussed earlier, how are we going to rein in the cost? Reining in prescription drug prices is a big part of it. And studies have shown that one in four people can't pay for their prescription medications. And I've seen patients use half, a third of the medications that they're supposed to have. They might be too ashamed to tell their doctors, and so they choose the medication that's the most expensive and stop taking it, even if it's an insulin, even if it's a blood thinner, that may actually cost them their lives. So this is a real issue to so many of our patients who make that trade-off every day between paying for medications and paying for some other life necessity for themselves or for their families. I would love to see federal action be taken. I'd love to see the federal government directly negotiate with drug manufacturers about prices. I'd love to see anti-price gouging laws occur on the national level. In the absence of those laws passing at the moment, I think it's great that our General Assembly here in Maryland is taking on a couple of bills that would make an impact, at least here in our state. So I gave testimony last week on a package of bills. One is to increase price transparency. The idea is that why should we be having such skyrocketing drug prices? What is the reason for it? You mentioned naloxone or Narcan, which is the life-saving medication, the life-saving antidote to an opioid overdose. The generic version of naloxone, the price of the generic version has more than doubled in recent years, which makes no sense. It's a generic medication available by the pennies in other countries.
So the argument that, you know, the R&D, the research and development costs associated with keeping this drug on the market or finding a better version of the drug, that's what the drug companies would probably say, is it not? That, they spend so much money on research and developing these drugs that they need to charge these high prices in order to make their businesses viable.
There are a few problems with this argument. First, specifically for generic medications, these are already generic. They're off patent, and so there is no research and development argument here. Again, for naloxone, it's available by pennies in other countries. And so at the very least, we should have an explanation from the drug manufacturers about why it is that the price is suddenly so high. Why is it that at a time of a public health emergency, that price is so high? And having that transparency might deter other companies from doing this in the future. The second thing about the research and development.
And by the way, if I could interrupt, wouldn't transparency also be really good for the stockholders in those companies? I mean, if you're holding stock in a big pharma company and they are completely open and transparent about their costs and what they're doing, I would think as an investor, that would be a good thing to know. Then you would be able to say, well, this company has got its act together and things look good. And this is probably information you would want to make to be an investor.
And sunshine is a powerful disinfectant. It's important for us to know, and especially for things like naloxone, which we're facing this crisis of opioid overdose deaths. I mean, there are tens of thousands of deaths every single year in the U.S. That's something that there is an antidote for. There is a way for us to save tens of thousands of lives. We should never be priced out of that life-saving ability. The R&D argument, though, is important because on the one hand, we do want to encourage innovation by drug companies. They do produce medications that are that advance science, that are important. But a few things here. Companies spend twice as much on marketing than they do on research and development, which is interesting because if there were really the cure for cancer, if there were really such an important advance, we should know about it. Why is there so much being spent on marketing? The other thing, too, is much of that research and development occurs not by the pharmaceutical company, but by taxpayer-funded, government-funded, National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, other types of government-funded research. And so we as taxpayers should also know why the price of drugs is so high. And when there is a life-saving public health emergency, that should be kept in check.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the City Health Commissioner here in Baltimore. Our number on midday for the Midday Health Watch today is 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Linda in Baltimore, welcome to the Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Tom, and congratulations, Dr. Nguyen. I was wondering if you would be willing to talk about the two GOP proposals to solve Medicaid, the block grant and the per capita grant ideas. Medicaid currently covers 1.25 million adults and children in Maryland, and we got an increase of about 400,000 people on Medicaid when we expanded Medicaid, one of the 31 expansion states in the country, and we currently get $6 billion a year in the state from the federal government, which is 60% of our Medicaid funding. And neither the block grant or the per capita proposals are going to come anywhere near covering those that expansion or the people currently in it. And these are our most vulnerable. There are sickest, there are kids, there are seniors, there are disabled. A lot of them are disabled. And I just wanted Dr. Nguyen to see if she could address that.
Thanks for your call, Linda. I appreciate it. In Speaker Ryan's policy brief about this, he talks about modernizing Medicaid, and it has a lot to do with, he calls it empowering states to design their own programs. But Linda makes a good point here. Maryland is one of many states who've expanded Medicaid under the ACA, and they could lose a lot of funding.
Absolutely. And Linda makes a great point about Medicaid, that Medicaid does exist to protect our most vulnerable. It is the ultimate safety net for individuals who really need it, for moms, for children, for seniors, for individuals with disabilities. Now, there is no question that reform of Medicaid in some way is necessary and helpful. I was part of a national study group that looked at potential reforms of Medicaid, including how can we encourage Medicaid to invest further upstream, invest earlier, for example, in things like housing. Is housing not healthcare? Can we also tailor Medicaid so that it's not only covering individuals after they get ill, but focus on prevention? The theory of changing Medicaid to block grants for states, the theory itself is not the problem. The problem is what happens in practice. If Maryland and other states get a significant reduction in how much we get to treat our most vulnerable at a time when we always keep on tightening our belt for this population that needs our help the most, then we get very concerned. Then we have situations of our most vulnerable individuals going without health care and then racking up bills that later make all of us pay more, not to mention the inhumane aspect of letting our fellow citizens go without access to health care. And I want to mention one very specific thing about an example of how Medicaid helps us here in Maryland. We have a successful program here that we always talk about, and I've talked about on your program before, Tom, called Be More for Healthy Babies, which is a public-private partnership in Baltimore City that has resulted in an unprecedented 38% decline in just 7 years in infant mortality. We save, on average, 50 babies a year because of the wraparound services, the comprehensive services that this program offers. Disruptions to Medicaid will also disrupt programs like Be More for Healthy Babies. I mean, these are the unintended consequences on our most vulnerable that we must safeguard against.
Kurt in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Wen. What's been your experience with Obamacare?
Okay, well, our experience, I'm a small business person in Baltimore, and our experience, I keep hearing this 25% increase quoted. Our experience has been far, far higher. In the last 3 years, possibly a little bit less, has gone up. Our insurance has gone up 100%. Me personally, I have two school-aged children, and my wife and I, two middle-aged adults, our premiums have gone from $800 a month to over $1,600 a month in the last 2 years. So I think that in all this discussion about low-income wage earners, that a lot of middle-class people and a lot of business people, small business people especially, are being forgotten. And we know people who are middle-aged who are dropping insurance because they flat-out can't afford it. I mean, literally, it's a $10,000 a year increase in our cost. The other thing that we've noticed that's really disturbing is we have some employees whose spouses work for larger companies or the government who get much lower rates than are available to us as a small business. And that's something that desperately needs to change. We feel like there's not an open market for us to purchase insurance. There's some restrictions, and we don't understand where they're coming from. So that's my comments.
Thank you for that call, Kurt. I mean, has your insurer given you a specific reason for the increases and the rate of increase, which is really quite astounding?
Is it
a matter of the market? In other words, is there less competition than there was 2 years ago when it started, or 3 or 4 years ago when it started?
Less competition, and the insurance companies are scrambling to cover their costs as the quotes that I've got is they're scrambling to recover their increased costs from having to enroll people on Obamacare, and they're hitting us because we're vulnerable. We don't have the leverage that a big company has. We don't have the leverage that the federal government or the state government or the city government has to negotiate with them, and they're absolutely crushing us.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Kurt. I appreciate it. Dr. Wen, I mean, this is a common problem for a lot of people whose rates and premiums simply have gone up an awful lot.
And I hear, Kurt, I hear that concern, and I can see how there is such opposition to Obamacare, to the ACA, because everyone is blaming the rising premiums, the rising cost on the ACA, instead of on the many other factors that are contributing to high cost of healthcare, including prescription drugs, including our system of paying for more, rewarding individuals and rewarding doctors and hospitals and systems for doing more rather than doing things that are high value.
Ordering all these extra tests and stuff like that.
Right. The Institute of Medicine, for example, shows that 30% of all tests that are done are unnecessary, and every unnecessary
30%.
Test. 30%. Which means that it's not just a matter of that particular test that's expensive. It also leads to further unnecessary tests and treatments. And so there is a lot of reform that has to happen. I completely agree with Kurt that that's the case. But it's not just Obamacare that's led us to these high costs. And in fact, we also have to look at what happens if we were to repeal something like Obamacare. What would happen to costs then? If there are alternate proposals for us to look at and compare them side by side and project project out and get economic analyses to see what is going to be the cost. Because I worry about Kurt. I worry about families and businesses and small business owners like Kurt who are being hurt and who may be priced out of healthcare themselves and not getting ideal care themselves. But we also need to look at what these alternate proposals are. Are we actually going to have cheaper, more high-quality healthcare? Or is this a ruse that makes it seem like it's cheaper in the short run, but actually ends up punishing the most vulnerable individuals and racks up high costs in the long run?
Lots more to talk about this, and we're, of course, going to continue to follow the saga of the repeal and replace efforts with the ACA in programs upcoming in the next few weeks. We're talking about it today with Dr. Lena Wen. She's the health commissioner of Baltimore City. It is the Midday Health Watch. We'll be back with more with Dr. Wen and more of your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @midday. Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the Midday Health Watch. Today, my guest today is Dr. Lena Wen, the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. If you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Wen, you can join our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. Lena, let's talk about a bill that's currently making its way through the General Assembly here in Maryland having to do with paid sick leave. Mm-hmm. This is one of those bills, the controversy has always been, you know, should the government require employers to do X or Y on a variety of issues? But paid sick leave, a lot of folks point to that as a way of actually ultimately reducing healthcare costs.
It's reducing cost, and frankly, it is the right thing to do for public health. I went to testify on behalf of the Baltimore City Health Department and public health officials on this bill. I have seen in the ER patients who waited to get care because they just couldn't get time off to go visit their primary care doctor. I remember this young guy, construction worker in his 20s, who scraped his leg. And it became redder and redder. He began developing a fever, but he thought that he would lose his job if he took the day off and went to his primary care doctor. He ended up waiting a week. And by that time, he had a severe infection, ended up having to have his leg amputated. I mean, this is an extreme example, but there are so many other examples of individuals who go to sick anyway. A study by the CDC found that more than half of food service workers go to work while they're sick, including when they're actively having vomiting and diarrhea. There have been cases of foodborne outbreaks. Right here in Maryland, there was a typhoid case of a restaurant worker who infected many other patrons. I mean, people are not supposed to go to work sick, but that choice is predicated on privilege, and it's a privilege that many individuals don't have. Paid sick leave also helps us to level that playing field because it is low-income workers who are the most heavily affected. And so for us, it's a necessity to prevent infectious illnesses. It allows people to seek timely care. And in the long run, it also reduces expensive medical costs. It increases worker productivity. And really, it's just the right thing to do. We don't think that any industry should be exempt, that it should not just be for larger businesses, because many of the restaurants that we're dealing with, actually the majority of restaurants, are small businesses. And their workers and their patrons, the clients, also have to have their public health be protected as well.
We should mention that Speaker Ryan will be telling us more about the Republican proposal to repeal and replace Obamacare as of Monday. They are on recess this week. He issued this brief sort of policy brief thing last Thursday. And, of course, it was very much overshadowed by President Trump's press conference, which happened on that very same day. So a lot of people didn't sort of notice it all that much. But we've got a couple of tweets, and this is something that's that strikes me as sort of fundamental to this. When it comes to the individual mandate, which is something that a lot of people on the right oppose, and they oppose it because it's government intervention and it's forcing people to do something that they may not want to do. The mandate, people say, that is required because that's the only way we create this pool that keeps healthcare costs reasonable for everybody. Doesn't that also just sort of boil down ultimately to the argument about whether or not healthcare is a right for every person, or whether it's this thing that, you know, you'll get if you've got the means? But is it a right for every one of our citizens to be insured? And is it something that the rest of us need to do to help those of us who aren't in a situation where it's sort of readily available through your employer or some other means?
I think there are two separate but related issues. The first is that core principle that you mentioned about whether healthcare is a right. And for me, if we all have a right to life, if we understand that we need to uphold this right to life, we also have to understand that we need a right to health. And right to health care is fundamental to that. For me as a physician, I can't endorse any proposal that doesn't have as at its core the principle, this ethic of healthcare as a basic human right. That's first and foremost. Second piece that's related is that even if somebody doesn't believe that the government has a right to or needs to be the provision of health care for everyone, there's actually another piece too, which is that it's not just about your health. You may choose to be unhealthy, but your lack of being healthy actually also affects me. It affects other people too. The most obvious example is infectious illnesses. If somebody has a communicable disease that's spread to other people, that's not just about their particular choice not to get it treated or to be around others. It's about everyone around them as well. But it's also a matter of cost. An individual who chooses to not be healthy also passes on that cost to the rest of society. And so even if we don't go with the rights argument for healthcare provision, it still ultimately is a responsibility for each of us, for our society.
I have a number of callers who I think want to put in a good word for the ACA. Michael in Catonsville, welcome to Midday Health Watch with Dr. Wen.
Yeah, hi. I just want to say that, you know, I'm a 47-year-old white guy with basically all the advantages in life. I don't consider myself to be one of the least fortunate people, and you might not think I need protection, but I have a chronic kidney condition that killed my grandfather at 52, and it nearly killed my father at 63. He had preventive care, so he lasted longer before the need for dialysis and ultimately a transplant. With technologies today, I could live into my 70s and die of something else and cost the system much less if I have access to care. I could never get care. Like, I could never get, excuse the noise, I could never get health care through the individual marketplace because I'd be priced out and I had a pre-existing condition. Now I can. I'm paying the same that your earlier small business caller was paying, maybe somewhere between $1,100 and $1,500 for myself, my wife, and my two kids through Obamacare. And it's the first time I've had that peace of mind. Now, as Ms. Wen was just saying, if you don't take care of me because you don't think it's responsibility, that's a political issue. But really, we're all interdependent, whether we like it or not, because my care is going to cost a heck of a lot, and it's going to cost a heck of a lot sooner if I don't have preventive care and access to hypertension medications and monitoring. So I'm just a normal guy who can't afford health insurance and wouldn't even be allowed to have it without the ACA. And at the same time, I'm totally sensitive to Kurt, I think his name was, a small business caller. But really, we can't, also as Ms. Wen said, it's really not a solution to say less coverage or catastrophic only coverage. We need more people to be more covered to manage the costs. And I think what I've heard is that this is going to be a hiccup where costs go up for a while until we get broader coverage and figure out other ways to manage costs as we bring people online.
Yeah, that's certainly the hope from a lot of people. Well, thank you for your call, Michael, and best of luck with your health. I mean, the balance between preventive care and emergency care, we have an email here from Richard who says an interesting point. I'd like to hear what you have to say about this, Dr. Wen. Contrary to expectations, this is Richard writing, he says, the insured actually use the emergency room more than uninsured people. despite the fact that insured obviously have coverage. He says, I favor the ACA, but this cost concerns me. Is that true?
The information, the data that Richard cites is biased for the following reasons. There are studies that show that though individuals who are newly insured use the emergency room, use the ER more. But one reason might be that these individuals have not gotten care for a long time. There is also an issue of physician and health provider shortage. So an individual may not have had time to go see their primary care doctor. They're newly insured, and now they want to get their issues addressed. I certainly have seen many patients who inappropriately use the ER for preventive services for primary care. It's not usually that person's fault. Paid sick leave, lack of paid sick leave is a problem because they might not have time off to go to the primary care doctor's office in the middle of the day. There may be many other extenuating circumstances. In addition, part of what complicates the data that Richard is citing too is that individuals who are uninsured still might have to pay for some type of ER care. Individuals who are uninsured are also more likely to be undocumented immigrants who may be afraid, especially in today's climate, of what happens when they go into a facility to seek care. So we have to focus on the fact that it is expensive care at the end of the line that we need to prevent. I'm an ER doctor, and I certainly believe in delivering excellent care if somebody comes into the ER. But the most important thing we can do is to prevent small problems from becoming larger, more deadly, and more expensive ones.
Kevin in Baltimore sends us an email and says, the ACA came along at the perfect time for me. I was unemployed and I couldn't afford COBRA. And right after I signed up for the ACA, I was in a hit-and-run car accident. And shortly thereafter, was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. Because of the ACA, I was able to get great care. I'm still alive and in remission. Now, the Republicans want to take that away from 20 million people. This is no way to make America great again. Well, Kevin, good luck with you and your health. Danny in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Thank you for having Dr. Nguyen and for being on. If you recall the roots of Republican insurance, President Nixon, before he got himself in trouble, was trying to have a single-payer system that would basically cover everybody. And if you look at the VA system, I just got out of the VA hospital. It's an excellent system. I don't care what anybody says about it. They hold costs down. And if you have a single-payer, you can hold the costs down, and you could also have a distributed insurance through the states that would also hold costs down. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Danny. I mean, a lot of folks have said, you know, we should have started with a single-payer system, and then there are other people now saying, well, if that's not going to fly politically, maybe a single-payer option. What's your take on that, Dr. Nguyen?
In the ideal world, a single-payer system would save money and would provide access to care in the way that we see it working in Canada. It would keep administrative costs down and provide that quality of care that we would want. But we don't have a situation now where the single-payer system could have passed. We have the ACA, which is far from perfect, but is getting us much closer to that goal of covering as many people as possible. Millions of people covered for the first time. Millions of people who can get access to life-saving medications who are preventing these small problems from becoming life-threatening emergencies. And the last thing that we need is for those protections to be taken away. We need a lot more people, like Kevin, for example, telling their stories about how the ACA has benefited them and what repeal would mean, because this cannot just be an abstract issue that we're debating some policies and politics. It needs to be about people, about patients, their families, and how this affects them.
We are running out of time, so we don't have a lot of time to talk about some things that I think we'll take up the next time that you're here. But I very much appreciate your coming by and talking about the ACA. And thanks to everybody who called and tweeted and emailed today. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to get to everybody's call, but clearly the ACA is something that's going to be on a lot of folks' mind, and we will here on Midday be covering it more and more in the ensuing weeks. As we mentioned, Speaker Ryan intends to tell us a little bit more about their ideas on this subject, their policy proposals, when they come back from recess next Monday. So, Dr. Nguyen, thank you very much. Congratulations again on your pregnancy, and best of luck to you and your husband as this wonderful process unfolds. Good
thank
to see you.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll see you next month. Dr. Lena Nguyen is the Health Commissioner of Baltimore City. This has been another installment of the Midday Health Watch. We've got a link to the City Health Department on our website. on over to WIPR.org/midday. Thanks to Dangerously Delicious Pies for providing lunch today. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. Speaking of dangerously delicious stuff, join us tomorrow for next installment of Whatcha Got Cookin'. John Shields and Sasha Wohlhandler will be here. We'll talk about great ideas for meals in one pot. Till then, I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate you being with us. Have a great day. We'll be right back.